Well, thank you for your attention. And as we gather and get ourselves together for this session, I hope to discuss a common misconceptions that are popular in culture today, in Christian culture today, about music. We've already looked at some. And I want to bring others to your attention. And I think you'll find this interesting. I don't think anybody is going to hold these misconceptions because they are usually to, all of them are to the left of positions that I would expect to be taken here. The first one that I want to discuss is the divine authorship of all music. It's kind of like what Dr. Bowder talked about, the divine authorship of culture. But this common misconception of music goes something like this. What God creates is good. God created music. Therefore, all forms of music are created by God and are good. This is exactly what Randy Stonehill himself says. He was one of the first Jesus rockers. Quote, rock and roll is just a thing. You break it down, and its rhythm and melodies and harmonies, God has created it so it can either be used or misused. Unquote. Well, the first question we want to ask is, how does Randy Stonehill know that God created rock and roll or ragtime or anything for that matter? He assumes incorrectly, like many CCM artists, that because God is the author of music as an art form, God is also responsible for the particular genres within music proper. But rock and roll, like any form of music, including classical music, is a product of the human imagination and soul. Let's see where this line of reasoning takes us if we just substitute a few words. Instead of music, let's substitute art and say, what God creates is good. God created art. Therefore, all forms of art, that's where we get in trouble, are created by God. And are good. Would this include then nude art, anti-art, avant-garde art, such as surrealism, or even pornography, which some claim is a form of art? I hope no Christian would accept that. Let me explain it another way. It is a fact that God created clay. Right? Now, if I take that clay and I mold it into a foul object, I cannot make God responsible for that object. Just because it is created from the raw materials, or just because it is molded from the raw materials that God created, indeed, God created the clay, we cannot make God responsible for what I have formed. But when Petra, no longer extant any longer, they're through, but very popular, says, God gave rock and roll to you, put it in the souls of everyone. If you love the sound, then don't forget the source. They are essentially reasoning that all music forms originate from God. They confuse the gift of music as a kind of raw material, which is indeed an endowment of God, with what man has done with the music, which is an operation of man. That's a terrible confusion, but that is misconception number one. Now, the second a problem that we want to look at, or misconception, I've titled the supremacy of the lyrics. The supremacy of the lyrics. This CCM argument holds that the morality of music is found in the lyrics of the music and not in the style. Now, it presupposes a way of thinking about language and about words. It assumes that words are somehow naturally related to the thing that they refer to and inseparably chained to it. Now, I'm going to engage you or baptize you in a very quick course in linguistics, Linguistics 101, to help explain some of this, actually structuralist linguistics. But it, for the most part, words are not naturally related to the things that they represent. Some words are. They're called onomatopoeia words, words like splash and lick. They sound like the very activities that you hear. Think about it sometime when you have time. What splash, psh, etc. But most words don't operate that way. They are more conventional, as our speaker beforehand stated. We don't think about the fact that there is no natural connection between the word dog and the four-footed animal with a tail. In German, the word is Hund. In Israeli, it's Kelev. In Sanskrit, it's Kutro. They don't sound at all alike, okay, because they are conventional. If the sound of the word was naturally related to the object, in this case, then every language in the world would call that four-footed animal a dog. And by the way, I mentioned the word lick, the sound. In many of the European languages, it has an L and a K sound. So it really does sound very much alike, even across languages, okay? Unrelated in most cases. But in any case, they would all sound alike. And if we agreed together that we were going to call this thing something else by another label, instead of a dog, we could call it a dole. I just made that up. Then we as a group agree that now, whenever I use the word dole, it stands for man's best friend. Okay, so that is, it just simply explains the conventional nature of language. I did this simply to show you that the meaning of most words is not locked in tight, and it can change with the context of the utterance when that changes. Now, I want you to make some observations about two statements that I'm going to make, okay? And just think about them for a second. The first utterance, I'm not frustrated. The second utterance, I'm not frustrated! Okay, there was a lot of visual effect to that. But even without that, suppose you were listening to it on tape, okay, you would still pick up the differences. The first observation is that in both utterances, we used exactly the same words in exactly the same order. Okay, so grammatically, if you were to examine these sentences grammatically, they would be identical if a grammarian were to look at them. There was nothing unusual about the first. The words and the tonal inflections were consistent. The meaning of the words and the tonal inflections were entirely consistent. Okay, but in the second, the words and the inflection of the voice, the pitch, the volume, the accent, they run in the opposite direction of the words. They make a mockery of the words, I'm not frustrated. And actually, it turns it into an ironic statement, doesn't it? I am really frustrated. Now, what I hope this demonstrates is that words do not carry meaning apart from context. And context includes the way in which they are dispensed or spoken. If something as minor as tonal inflection can disrupt and even change the meaning of words, how much more the musical style that accompanies a song? Most secular musicologists recognize that the musical context influences the way in which lyrics are comprehended. I quoted Robert Walser earlier. I'm going to quote him again. You have it on your copy. Quote, before any lyrics can be comprehended, before harmonic or rhythmic patterns are established, timbre instantly signals genre and effect. Imagine this text being done by AC/DC with raucous screaming and pounding. I hear footsteps and there's no one there. I smell blossoms and the trees are bare. Now compare Frank Sinatra crooning it backed by strings. The musical cues create very different effects. One is a frantic agony of paranoia. The other is the delicious disorientation of bourgeoisie love. Unquote. Now what this means is that the lyrics, I hear footsteps and there's no one there, I smell blossoms but the trees are bare, mean something totally different when AC/DC sings them as when Sinatra sings them. I'll continue with Walser. But I would argue that musical codes are the primary bearers of meaning. Lyrics, like costume and the performer's physical motions, help direct and inflect the interpretation of the meanings that are most powerfully delivered, those suggested by the music. Simon Frith, who I quoted earlier, likewise emphasizes the priority of the music over the lyrics in rock communication. Sociologists of popular music have always fallen for the easy terms of lyrical analysis. Such a word-based approach is not helpful at getting at the meaning of rock. Most rock records make their impact musically rather than lyrically. The words, if they are noticed at all, are absorbed after the music has made its mark. The crucial variables are the sound and the rhythm. Unquote. The author of Dancing in the Dark, Quentin Schultz, quotes, I'm quoting next, says, the problem with trying to pin down the lyrical meaning is that rock and roll has always expressed more and meant more than its lyrics alone. The text is but one avenue to the meaning of the song. Unquote. Same author, in reference to the group Guns N' Roses, says, lyrics do not offer a reliable guide to deciphering their public image or the mood of the music itself, which can speak as loudly as any set of words. These are not, unquote, these are not fundamentalists who are saying these things. So then I do think lyrics are important, that they play an important role in musical communication, but at least in pop, we see that the music has the primary role of conveying meaning. Another misconception that Christians hold today has to do with the limits of both man and music. I've titled this autonomy. CCM's aesthetic leads to the conclusion that man is a free agent when it comes to appreciating beauty. Nevertheless, we need to make some observations about, theological observations about music, is that whatever music is, it is created. It is not the creator. It is not infinite like the creator, but finite. And that means it has limits and guidelines. It has boundaries that can be violated. We saw some of those with the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 14. Nevertheless, if we make a musical style something that can stand entirely on its own and is answerable to nothing but the taste of the individual, we end up saying that music can be whatever a person desires. In other words, music loses its boundaries and fails to be creaturely. And this is evident in certain types of musical forms that are popular today, such as rap, noise music, and punk. These are almost beyond musical definition. But because you don't have any boundaries, and that's why it took so much time to define music at the beginning of the first lecture. Now, when it comes to what is good and bad in music, this philosophy essentially claims that man is the measure of truth. The individual's tastes override everything else. You remember Eric Harris, one of the Columbine murders? Well, in one of his memoirs, they found this statement of his. He simply said, "I am the law." In doing so, he is obviously stating that he is the measure of truth when it comes to ethics. Now, this is exactly what CCM does when it comes to aesthetics. The individual is the law. You determine what is good and bad. Because really, there is nothing good and bad to begin with. Contrary to this philosophy, though, the Bible teaches us that man is not self-governing, but he is dependent, himself a creature. Only God is self-sufficient and the creator of standards. Man is finite, on the other hand, and must depend on God. Now, this is especially so in our ability to appreciate music, art, and beauty, because it's one of the elements of the image of God within us. Our capacity to appreciate beauty is a miniature of the divine attribute. As we said earlier, animals cannot appreciate beauty. They may be beautiful, but they cannot make judgments of beauty or ugliness. And because our aesthetic impulse is part of the image of God, it requires us to look to God for its regulation. So then, we can never claim that there's just no disputing my taste. To claim, then, that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and there is some truth to that, I'm not denying that, but as objectively speaking, that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and that the individual moral consciousness is sovereign in aesthetics, is to deny the creator-creature distinction and a license for aesthetic anarchy. And that's what we have today. We have aesthetic anarchy. You just have to observe. This autonomous feature of CCM's aesthetic actually parallels the worldview of the atheist. And this is a very serious charge, so let me explain. In an atheistic universe, there is no such thing as transcendent or objective laws of any kind that are always true and binding. No laws of ethics, science, or beauty. As far as ethics, there is no such thing as transcendent or real evil in an atheistic universe. A consistent atheist must be morally indifferent to the hijackings of 9/11, to Hitler's Holocaust, or to serial killers. The reason they have to take this view is because if something is eternally right or wrong, that determination has to be made apart from human beings. So to make a long story short, a universe with transcendent ethics is a universe governed by God, something that is impossible for the atheist to admit. Now, when we move from ethics to aesthetics, the atheist holds the same position. In an atheistic universe, there is no such thing as transcendent or objective beauty, because there can be no laws of beauty. Nothing is actually beautiful or ugly. These are only relative to the individual or community. For instance, two individuals could be gazing at a sunset on the Hawaiian Islands. One could comment that the scene is beautiful, majestic, and breathtaking, while the other could find it unappealing, ugly, or repulsive, preferring rather the sight of a junkyard. Now, as unthinkable as this sounds, a consistent atheist must admit that neither individual is right or wrong, since there is no such thing as true beauty to begin with. There is only relative beauty, beauty in the eye of the beholder. Now, this hit home once. I was in a conversation with a punk rocker, a young guy. He's probably about 20 years old, and he had a T-shirt on with a logo for the punk group Bad Religion. And what it is a void sign, a cross, a crucifix with a void sign over it. And I recognized it immediately, and I started talking to him, and I asked him about it. And he said that, you know, he followed this group, and I said, are you an atheist? He said, yes. And we talked about those things for a while. And I said, so you don't believe that there is such a thing as true beauty, do you? And it was like when I said that, he was so elated and so excited that somebody from the outside actually understood his philosophy. He just kept insisting, that's right, there's no such thing as true beauty. There's nothing, no beauty at all. It's all relative. He was flattered in a sense that I would recognize that component of his position. A consistent atheist really will hold that. And by the way, as an aside, I asked him if he was familiar with a Christian punk, and he said, "Oh yeah, he was. In fact, he was currently listening to one of their albums, a group called Spitfire." And I asked him, "Doesn't that offend you? Are these Christian lyrics and things like that?" He goes, "Yeah, but you know, it's no big deal. I mean, I just like to listen to the sound." And the lyrics didn't mean that much to him. He was able to bypass them. It was very nice. We left on friendly terms. He offered me a CD of Spitfire and said, "Thank you. That's just what I need, another punk CD to my collection." But anyway, this unknowledgeable atheist will say that. Now, what is frightening is that CCM's philosophy of aesthetics is almost identical to the atheist. Like the atheist, the implication of their aesthetic is that there is no such thing as transcendent or objective beauty in music. They won't say it, but that's the implication of it. That's the outworking of it. And there is no such thing as intrinsically good or bad music. All evaluations of music are person relative, community relative, and genre relative. So there's no disputing my taste. As in atheism, the individual in CCM is entirely sovereign in art appreciation. And the outworking of their aesthetic results in the same types of absurdities that we would encounter with the atheist. The CCM advocate can no more scorn someone who enjoys the melody of a jackhammer or a Black and Decker drill than the atheist can. Because whenever you plunge yourself into the black hole of relativism, you end up affirming the absurd. Now, they will certainly contest that. I'm not going to sit down for that and say that you are inventing impossible scenarios, Black and Decker drills, jackhammers. Nobody really calls that music. Now, first of all, these are not impossibilities because the moral depravity of man permits this type of thing. Second, these things have already been documented in the music of John Cage, the futurist, the Dadaist, and punk and noise music. And even if we couldn't document a single case of noise music, CCM's worldview still forbids them from labeling any form of music as absurd or anything that anyone calls music. Let's move on in your outline to reductionism. And this is the misconception that the moral neutrality of music can be proven by examining the individual elements of a style in isolation from the other elements. This is called reductionism, which is to take something that is offensive or objectionable and to break it down into elements that are inoffensive to its critics. Take something bad, chop it up until you get something good, and then tell people that they're really offended by something that is harmless or even good. Remember, the individual I quoted at the beginning, Randy Stonehill, it's rock and roll, rock and roll is just a thing. You break it down, rhythm and melody and harmonies. God has created it, so it can be either used or misused. So what he's saying is it's either rhythm, melody, or harmonies. He has dissected it into three components that nobody can object to. I don't know anybody here is going to object to melody. Okay, Steve Miller states says much the same thing. Granted, much of rock music does generate an exciting atmosphere, but excitement is not wrong in itself. Excitement itself is neutral. But a rock artist has the opportunity to channel that excitement toward positive or negative ends. Now, what he has done himself, Miller, is to take rock music and break it down into its components like excitement. And since there's nothing wrong with excitement, he's going to come up to you and say, why do you have a problem with it? Very clever strategy. Another individual, Al Manconi, says that rock music in itself expresses only such things as passion, action, energy, tension, and urgency. And he is also using reductionism. Now, he's right in one sense. I mean, it does do those things. It's undeniable. But is that all it does? Since things like excitement or energy are apparent in negative feelings of rebellion and rage, as well as in love, joy, and happiness, we are told that this is all there is to the style of music. And how can that offend anyone? You can't object, since there's nothing wrong with those things in themselves. Now, is there a problem with this? Yes. The problem is that this type with reductionism is that the value of the elements of the compound by themselves, torn apart, is considered to be the same as their value together as one. And that is entirely false. In the same way, you could argue that hydrochloric acid, which is made up of hydrogen and chlorine, is harmless to you because hydrogen is useful and safe. It's found in water. It's found in the atmosphere. And chlorine is a disinfectant, and it's good. And therefore, hydrochloric acid is harmless. The same type of reason could be used that. We know it's not. Another problem with this type of reductionism is that music communicates far more than just the building blocks of emotions and moods. It can genuinely speak to our emotions, as many musicologists have already documented, and you've heard that here. Lastly, if music does communicate to our emotions, moods, and feelings, and not all emotions, moods, and feelings are good or appropriate in music, then it is very difficult to maintain that music is morally neutral. Let's look at one more case of reductionism from quite a knowledgeable Presbyterian named Kevin Twitt. Rock music is also an expression of and symbol for celebration. Rock is just fun. It can be an expression of, quote, a kind of innocent, exultant hedonism, a delight in the simple pleasures of the body and of consciousness, of the goodness of being alive. In this case, Twitt is reducing rock's message to the components, again, that no one can object to. Fun, bodily pleasure, consciousness, and life. But are these the distinguishing characteristics of rock music? Is this why it has millions, billions of patrons worldwide? I would say no, these aren't. You can, quote, delight in the simple pleasures of the body and of consciousness, of the goodness of being alive, when you take a hot shower in the morning. This is not why people listen to rock music. Musically, you can delight in the simple pleasures of the body and of consciousness, of the goodness of being alive, when you listen to a Sousa march, a racy fiddle, or the Scottish bagpipes, or a child's song. If this is all that rock patrons wanted, they could listen to bluegrass or bagpipes or a child's song. This is one of the ways that one of the antidotes for that, when you question someone or you suspect reductionism. I remember Benny Hinn once was talking, was justifying his lavish lifestyle and all his money, and if he gains it legitimately, I have no problem with it, but they asked him why he drove a Mercedes, and he used reductionism. He said, I just like to drive foreign cars. Because what would be the first question you'd ask him? Well, why don't you drive a Toyota? Right? This is the kind of strategy that is being used, and you need to vet it out in a manner similar to that. Anyway, let's go back to this statement of his. Is it right because it's fun? Because that's what Twitt said. It's just fun. Now, if you've read my book, you know that just, can be a code word for reductionists. And this writer uses it in that way. It's not just fun. There are many sinful acts that are also fun. Sexual immorality, vandalism, gossip, and gluttony are also fun. But we can't say that gluttony is just fun. It's fun to be sure, but it's more than fun. It's sin. I'm sorry. I know we're eating in half an hour, but this was in my notes. I had to say it. Another popular misconception, and this does relate to music, is what I call the encyclopedic view of the Bible. And this is a way of applying the Bible to everyday moral choices. It essentially claims that what the Bible clearly forbids, we must forbid. But where there is no clear command, we are free to engage as long as our conscience allows. I was taught this ever since I was first came to Christ in just about every church that I went to. In the worship wars, this is known as the normative principle of worship, as opposed to the regulative principle. And this is the standard evangelical disposition toward biblical guidance on ethics and culture, which is that the Bible is essentially a catalog or an encyclopedia of prohibitions, thou shalt nots. And if a certain prohibition is not listed, in fact or in principle, we are free to engage as long as our conscience is not defiled. And because the Bible doesn't say anywhere that rock music is wrong or that any kind of music is intrinsically good or evil, then we are free to engage as long as our conscience permits. Now, the problem is that the Bible was not written as a catalog of prohibitions, but guides our behaviors many times on larger principles, worldviews, and theology as a whole, not from a single text. For God to cover every sin of every culture specifically would require a book of enormous size, unthinkable size. Notice that the Bible doesn't say anything specifically about plagiarism, hijacking, internet porn, or gambling. Nothing specifically. These are condemned, certainly, yes, condemned under wider principles required of us, such as honesty in the case of plagiarism instead of stealing, love rather than malice in the case of hijacking, chastity, not lust, in the case of internet porn, and stewardship and industriousness rather than greed, in the case of gambling. Therefore, even if the Bible said nothing against the sin of homosexuality, specifically, if it didn't, and I believe it does, I'm just hypothetically saying if it didn't, we could still argue against such behavior entirely on the basis of the created order and the limitations of the human anatomy, based on principle. You can back that up with a couple of texts. Galatians 5, 19 through 21. Now the deeds of the flesh are evident, which are immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envying, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these of which I forewarn you, just as I have forewarned you, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. Now, Paul is surely saying that this list that he has given of the deeds of the flesh does not exhaust those things that he considers to be deeds of the flesh. But there are deeds that are similar to them, though they are unnamed. Hebrews 5:14. But solid food is for the mature, who because of practice or use have their senses trained to discern good and evil. In this passage, the writer explains that he has much that he wants to communicate to his readers about Christ being a priest after the order of Melchizedek. But he hesitates because of their spiritual incompetence. As he describes their condition, he illustrates spiritual maturity and immaturity. Those who operate in the elementary instruction of Christianity are compared to infants who drink milk. They lack experience and skill in how they find moral guidance from the Bible. The spiritually mature, on the other hand, are like those who eat solid food, who by using their moral abilities are conditioned to distinguish between good and evil. They are skillful in the application of moral principles. But the immature are restricted to the basic teachings of right and wrong available in special revelation. So then Scripture rejects the idea of the normative principle, at least as it is practiced within contemporary evangelicalism today. And by the way, no true believer actually lives by this principle. You can't in this modern world. Our case against CCM should not depend on a specific text that settles the issue once and for all. Our case should be based on the categories of systematic theology that CCM violates, such as human depravity, Pelagianism, relativism, the adoption of an atheistic worldview, aesthetic anarchy, and independence from God. It should be based on the incompatibility of Rock's musical vocabulary with God's nature and his desire for our conduct and affections. Another misconception or method of illustrating the neutrality of music, we're moving on to the next subheading, is to recall the public hysteria of earlier rock styles and performances and then point out that people no longer have the same reaction to the music. The obvious conclusion is that factors other than the style were responsible for their reactions. You hear this quite often. Again, I'm quoting Steve Miller, who uses this line of reasoning to support his argument for musical neutrality. It's not original with him, as you'll see. If you watch people calmly listen to the Beatles today, you will wonder what all the fuss was about. If the problem was inherently in the style, there would be no difference in the response people have to the music today from the response they had in the 60s, unquote. That makes sense. Steve Lawhead, who preceded Miller, said the same thing. He said, watch a film of the Beatles at Shea Stadium. The stands packed with thousands of screeching, crying fans, and you wonder what all the commotion was about. Was it the music? No. If music was the mover, those bouncy songs would still drive people crazy. Put on a stack of old Beatle records and you won't get anybody to scream and tear their hair. Now, what Miller and Lawhead at first seemed to have a valid point, since there were several factors aside from the music that produced Beatlemania and similar manias. And the only thing that this illustration proves is that music produces its effect by way of sign and referent rather than by being forced into the listener, which which we talked about earlier, as music a symbol, not as direct influence or the hypodermic view. Now, this does not mean that musical styles are morally neutral, since musical symbols are still effective carriers of moral meaning, as we have seen. To sum it up, these individuals uncritically accept the inconsistency of human response as an indication of neutrality in music. Further, they fail to consider the psychological phenomenon of desensitization, and that's what I've actually titled this section. It's also called sensory fatigue. Repeated exposure to any stimulant will eventually lead to tolerance, dissatisfaction, and burnout. When the product becomes unappealing, it must be replaced with something more powerful. Researcher Bernice Martin says this: each style, once all of its main features have been developed, naturally moves into more extreme and emphatic versions of itself until it exhausts its own logic and provokes the introduction of a counter-style. Some such process has surely happened in pop music. This is one of the reasons why the style of rock music did not remain static. Oh, I'm sorry, end quote. Now I'm speaking. This is one of the reasons why it didn't remain static, why the Everly Brothers would eventually be replaced by the Doobie Brothers, and so on. Simon Reynolds comments, "The problem is that, as with any drug or intoxicant, tolerance builds up rapidly, but noise hipsters can cope with absurd levels of outrage, dissonance, and therefore require extreme after extreme in order to feel stimulated, mind blown, burnout approaches." Now, Nathan Rubin explains how heavy metal was a response to desensitization. "To retain the intensity Presley had generated simply by sneering and singing the country blues, rock and roll during the 70s was obliged to turn assaultiveness up to the max. The result was called heavy metal. To create it then, since loud sounds are more aggressive than soft ones, make heavy metal loud. Since males are more aggressive than females, make it male. Since make it screamed rather than sung, distorted rather than pitched, lumbering rather than sprightly, insistent rather than diffuse, massed rather than single. In fact, all that hard rock players really had to do was exaggerate what they had already been doing, playing riffs still louder, distorting their timbres, and the solos still faster." Unquote. Jeffrey Arnett, we've heard from him before. "Even within popular music, vulgar art did not begin with heavy metal. The rock music of the 1960s and 70s also exalted vulgarity. But heavy metal has reformulated the audaciousness and excess of rock for the 1980s and 1990s, now that rock has become tame and respectable. Heavy metal came forth in part as a response to rock's new docility. Heavy metal performers made their performances and their songs outrageous enough to violate even the new expanded boundaries of social acceptability. Increasingly sophisticated sound technology gave them the weapons they needed to create a new sound of unprecedented fierceness to accompany their fierce, defiant, angry ideology. And the adolescents of the world listened and responded by the millions." Joe Stussy says, attributes the rapid changes in rock to competition within the industry. "To grab the spotlight from the current stars, a new band member must play louder, have more elaborate props, cut bigger holes in their jeans, wear more spikes and chains, shout more obscenities, and bite heads off more bats than the current groups." So this then explains the current, the rapid changes in rock music and why people don't react to the Beatles and Elvis as they used to. As Stussy again puts it, what were once vices are now habits. The next area is skill. Sometimes CCM advocates will appeal to the level of skill that is necessary to play rock music in order to deflect charges of aesthetic inferiority. This claim would only apply to certain forms of rock and really certain individuals, not all forms. But on the whole, it takes a great deal more skill to play a country fiddle than any of the instruments of a rock band, just in a general sense, and of course in many classical instruments also. In some rock genres, skill is actually a liability. This is because, as it is in punk, in punk's aesthetic agenda was to compose a type of music that was so barren of virtuosity, a craftsmanship, and musicianship. In fact, the members of the Sex Pistols were chosen because they lacked musical skill. I've often said I could have become a punk musician. I have no musical skill. Christian rocker Steve Taylor says this exact thing. And I also knew that new wave music was essentially four guys getting together who couldn't play musical instruments, and that appealed to me because I couldn't play anything either. Now, it's true that rock music has some very talented guitarists, and it would be wrong to say that they're completely without talent. Some of them are extremely talented, and some of the in some genres that's actually considered important to the guitarists like Eddie Van Halen, Randy Rhoads, and names like that. But looking at it, you know, just from a biblical standpoint, the skill necessary does not justify something aesthetically or morally. Okay, that's the principle, that's the main principle. Whether it takes skill or not doesn't matter, okay, or a lot of skill. Doesn't really matter. The point is, even if it does involve skill, it doesn't matter because one can be very good at doing something very bad. It takes a great deal of skill, timing, coordination, and creativity to be a good nightclub stripper. But that doesn't justify the enterprise, does it? Now, in the remaining moments, I want to, this is not in your outline, I want to address Harold Best again and revisit the topic of aesthetics. Best is one of the intellectuals of the movement. He used to be conservative in music. And so I take a great interest in him. As you recall, CCM holds to the relativistic philosophy of music. The music or beauty exists only in the eye of the beholder. Best is aware of how inflammatory a term like relativism is to evangelicals, and he attempts to sanctify it and to neutralize it in some way. And here's how he does it. He tries to escape the concept of objective beauty and immunize genres like jazz, rock, etc., from criticism by an analogy from nature. He claims that each created thing has its own type of beauty and should not be compared with another species which also has its own type of beauty. 1 Corinthians 15, 40. There are heavenly bodies and earthly bodies. But the beauty of the heavenly body is of one kind, and the beauty of the earthly is of another kind. Okay, so distinguishing between species in that sense. He says, you don't compare the beauty of an orchid to a cactus or a golden retriever to a bulldog. You can compare one orchid with another orchid and one cactus with another, but not across boundaries. Likewise, you don't compare jazz with classical, but jazz with jazz and classical with classical. You keep them in their own categories. And there's also the next verse in 1 Corinthians 15:41, which says that star differs from star in glory or beauty. affirming that there is a difference in beauty within categories, as Best asserts. But there's still a problem here, because as in 1 Corinthians 15:41, you still have not escaped the need for some kind of an objective or transcendent ideal to determine which star is more beautiful. We still need to have a philosophy of transcendent beauty in order to make comparison within categories. So Best is still in trouble. You really can't determine, even within categories, what the most beautiful is, or the better. Because even in comparing two bulldogs, there are still no criteria for determining which one is more beautiful. Is it the one with the brown patch over its eye, or the white patch? Is it the one with the black and tan body, or the brindle-colored body? You still have that problem. And when it comes to human beings, this becomes even more difficult. How do we know whether one person is objectively more beautiful than another? Are Marty Feldman and Robert Redford of equal beauty? If not, how do you tell the difference? You can tell how old I am using Feldman. He's no longer alive. When Proverbs 31:30 says that beauty is fleeting, it is depreciating the importance of beauty in choosing a mate. That's the main point there. But it implies also that not all young women are beautiful. The statement also implies that the beauty of a young woman depreciates with age. There is a greater beauty and a lesser beauty. And unless there was some such thing as objective beauty, this statement would be meaningless, since an old woman would be just as beautiful as a young maiden in a relativist economy. I'll get off the topic, that topic, and talk about flowers, because that's safer. James 1:11 says, "For no sooner has the sun risen with a burning heat than it withers the grass, its flower falls, and its beautiful appearance perishes." Like Proverbs 31:30, here the beauty of the flower is temporary and is less beautiful after experiencing the elements. James is saying that the flower changed aesthetically from the condition of beauty to non-beauty. And again, if beauty was relative, he could not make such a statement. It is much as a withering flower may be just as beautiful as a fresh one, depending on the opinion of the individual. Now, Best might claim that these examples betray an internal standard of beauty. It wouldn't apply to music, such as the healthiest in nature. Remember, we're talking about nature. The healthiest is the most beautiful, or the most pristine is the most beautiful. The healthiest, let's look at that one. One could say that a withered flower is not beautiful because it is no longer healthy and strong. Therefore, what is ravaged by sin lacks beauty. And in a sense, that's true. But that doesn't solve the problem. Because both the bulldogs are healthy. Both Feldman and Redford are healthy. They were at one time. You could say that the most pristine example is the most beautiful in nature. The beauty the beauty is equated with freshness, newness, and not age. But a newly hatched robin, if you ever seen one, has no feathers at all, has bulging eyes, and it looks frightening. It's by far inferior to an adult. And finally, if we admit that the ravages of sin deteriorate beauty, then we must also admit that the same sin distorts and impairs our ability to appreciate beauty. There is something else that Best must consider when he uses this comparison of nature with music, and that is that natural artifacts incorporate beauty with utility. Every feature of an animal serves some practical function for its survival. Therefore, we can make aesthetic statements about animals relative to their survival design. We can say, that a crocodile, with its spike-armored body and fangs, is actually beautiful and magnificent because we recognize that it is superbly suited for its task. But is it heresy to compare a crocodile to a swan or a peacock, as Bess would say? I would say it is not. Both the swan and the peacock are more beautiful than the crocodile. There is a beauty within categories, to be true, but there is a beauty that crosses categories. There is a reason why the Yosemite Valley in California and the Swiss Alps attract thousands of tourists every year, whereas a muddy watering hole in Texas attracts none. Human beings constantly make aesthetic comparisons across species and kinds, and with good reason. It would be an absurd exercise in affirmative action to insist that the Texas watering hole is just as beautiful as Yosemite, just in a different way, and therefore deserves equal time on your wall and on your postcards or on your calendar. 1 Corinthians 15:40 through 41 never claims that the different kinds of beauty are all equal in beauty. I'll end with one more problem that Bess comparison creates. If it is illegal to compare the elements of one category or species with another, then it would also be illegal to compare the worst example of one category with the best example of another. It would be impossible to say, under Bess economy, that a fresh apple is more beautiful than a discolored, emaciated orange with open sores and wormholes, because you just don't compare apples and oranges, if you're Harold Bess. Take the example of the withering flower of James and the cactus of Harold Bess. It would be impossible to say that a fresh, healthy cactus is aesthetically superior to a withered flower. Bess' view would even prevent that level of aesthetic comparison because it crosses categories. And it has one final problem, and that is that you can create finer and finer taxonomies to the point of sui generis. Why should we stop with categories such as orchids? Why not go further? Why not insist that withered orchids should only be compared with other withered orchids and not with fresh orchids? Why not insist that the beauty of old women should only be compared with other old women and not with young ones? But the Bible, as we have seen, crosses both of these artificial categories and makes comparisons of beauty anyway.